Welcome to the TARDIS Library, a place to talk comics, novels, audios and more from the worlds of Doctor Who.
G'day everyone, Rob here, and welcome to yet another edition of the TARDIS Library. This is going to be a really quick intro from me this time around, because I'm not actually reviewing anything this episode. We've got more than enough material from Lex and from Kevin talking about Doctor Who comics, Torchwood audios, all sorts of fun stuff, and I hope you really love it. I'll be back after you hear from our reviewers.
Okay, time to review issue 3.1. of the 11th Doctor comic. The title is Remembrance. Definitely this is an issue of a few things we'll all be remembering from the year 2016. The writer is Rob Williams. The artist is I.N.J. Culbard. Colorist, Triona Farrell. And the letterer is Richard Starkings and Comicraft's Jimmy Betancourt. And so begins another year of the 11th Doctor comic. There is some very different looking art in here. I like it. It's exciting and new to me. There's not a lot of detail, but it's just enough to make some interesting expressions so you don't feel like you're missing that personal interaction with your characters. Yeah, and there's almost like a mathematical precision to the shading and objects, too. It's like a lot of really straight lines, that kind of deal. I don't know. Difficult to describe. So I had a bit of a laugh seeing that the TARDIS is featured on the main character bio page. And I'm surprised they didn't just add in Jones. Yes, Jones, the Doctor's companion from 2 years ago. But no, the TARDIS gets a well-deserved turn at being a main character in this issue, even though she's no more a character than she usually is. Anyways, this comic gets right into action as soon as you open the cover, with a giant truck about to run you over. Yeah, you open the page, and you're blasted with an impulse to dodge out of the way of your comic, lest you be hit by Bessie Number 2, a gigantic Whomobile truck. It's huge. And coming right at you. So, it starts off great. This issue basically had me laughing immediately, right off the bat, on the first page, and onwards, until the very end. The Doctor somehow got his hands on a Fez, once again, though as usual, it doesn't stay on his head very long, and a number of other, rather explicit jokes occur. You'll see what I mean soon. So, this issue takes place in London, more or less London, which is cool, and there are a lot of strange, sweaty, red-faced men in suits wandering around, muttering one single word over and over again. Britsit. Yes, it is what you think it is. They're all chasing after the Doctor and Alice, for some reason. A few of them are chasing after him, literally on high horses. They're these high-floating, horse-like robot things. Also, I should mention, it doesn't quite take place in London. It's an intergalactic colony based off of Britain. Very quickly, things start to get outrageously political. The colony is named Britsit 247. According to the Doctor, it is a British colony created because people, presumably the red-faced men in suits, got really cross about something and traveled off across the stars to create their own world built entirely on their mutual annoyance. It's one way to view the Brexit issue, I suppose. It goes on with the Doctor saying, "Eventually, they forgot what they were annoyed about and just carried on being annoyed anyway." Wow. Some bulldozing satire here by Titan Comics. Hello, angry comic artists. We can hear you now. Thanks. You know? Okay, yeah. There is a lovely bit of memorandum about David Bowie in this issue as well. If you've been reading the 11th comic for as long as I have, you'll remember Jones. He is essentially David Bowie, and he had some fantastic adventures and good times with the Doctor in this comic. So this bit of this issue is giving remembrance to David Bowie's passing on his birthday month, no less. His birthday's in January. The Doctor apparently is okay with being on the awful Brexit colony only because he found Jones's final album in existence. But on page 6, things start to get outright ridiculous. A giant robot threateningly looms over the city above them, strikingly, indisputably resembling Boris Johnson. But instead of incessantly muttering Brexit like all the other guys, this giant robot mumbles, and then suddenly remembers what he's supposed to say by blurting, "Ah, Brexit!" I thought this was enough, but it just keeps going. Next line of Alice, "Brexit." They keep saying that, don't they? The doctors reply, "Well, Brexit means Brexit, Alice. I think we can all agree on that." I don't know what to say. I love it. But is this really appropriate for a comic? There's very little originality here to go on in terms of beginning a legitimate new Doctor Who story. But truly, I wouldn't trade it in for another comic story. I'm just saying I'm bewildered and outright flabbergasted by their choice in doing this. Overall, I must say this issue is pretty fantastic, hilarious, and a lot of fun. The dialogue is wonderfully entertaining. For a change. The comic usually has its moments at least once in an issue, but this one is it's constant. I really enjoyed everything they said. And at the very end of the issue, they end up on a very intriguing new planet. It is at least leaving off with something that they can use for a legitimate Doctor Who story. And there's an old Doctor Who baddie that returns with a new twist in this issue. Hint, I bet you can't remember who it could be, even if you tried. Their title of remembrance for this issue couldn't be more appropriate. It's been a very entertaining issue. Awesomeness to the bossomeness. I'm not sure what that means either, but thanks for listening, and be back next month.
Hi there. I'm back at last with another whirlwind round of reviews from the weird and wonderful world of Doctor Who. Try saying that 3 times fast. So as promised, this time it's going to be slightly different. I'm frantically playing catch-up with my 12th Doctor comic reviews, so I'll be covering issues 12 and 13 of the latest Year 2 series. Don't worry, it'll still be my usual in-depth look, just 2 for the price of 1. Plus, I'm also branching out to take a listen to a series of audio stories concerning that secret organisation that's outside the government and beyond the police. Yes, it's Torchwood. That'll be along in a short while, but let's start the episode with the first comic of the month. And it's the 12th Doctor Year 2, number 12, part 2 of Terror of the Cabinet Noir by Robbie Morrison and Mariana Lacoustre. We ended part 1 with the Doctor in 1695 in the company of the gutsy Julie d'Aubigny, and narrowly escaping the grip of the sadistic Captain Verloc, who seemingly cannot die and appears to have some kind of moving blackness leaking from his eye sockets. Verloc in turn is employed by His Eminence Cardinal Richelieu, whom the Web of Time said he should have died 50 years ago. It's clear when Verloc reluctantly reports the Doctor's escape to the Cardinal that both men know far more than they should, since they talk of extraterrestrial technology, teleporters and DNA traces. And the Cardinal sets his tame gargoyle creatures off to track down the pair of fugitives. Meanwhile in the TARDIS, the Doctor analyses the black liquid left on Julie's sword from when she stabbed Verloc, and identifies it as sentient dark matter fused with human genetic material. Wanting to find out more, he materialises the ship inside the Bibliothèque Mazarine, Paris's foremost library. Confronted by the curator who brandishes a large gun, the Doctor uses the psychic paper to convince him that they're really an angelic visitation from God, and the frightened man begins to spill all he knows about the rise of Richelieu. Via another flashbook in the same scratchy sepia style as we had last issue, the Doctor and the reader learns that the zealous Cardinal created an infallible intelligence network, the Cabinet Noir, to intercept any correspondence that he deemed suspicious. All alchemical documents were housed in a secret black library, never to be used. That is, until Richelieu decided to forestall his own imminent death and began to experiment with necromancy. Opening a portal to a hellish dimension, he welcomed its occupants into our world, and since then has secretly ruled Paris with a cruel hand, while not aging a day, all the while waiting for his ultimate victory. Just as he hands the Doctor the key to the back library, the curator is killed by the arriving gargoyles. Julie d'Aubigny's taunts goad them to attack, and a frantic battle ensues. It's only when Julie uses the curator's gun to blast the head off one of the monsters that they're revealed as robotic automatons. Automatons that can breathe fire. Dodging the bolts of flame, the Doctor discovers the door to the Black Library and drags Julie inside. Searching the astrological charts, he finds something important, but suddenly the gargoyles are back in force. In retaliation, he uses the power of the sonic screwdriver to augment Julie's powerful opera singing voice, and the resultant shockwave shatters the creatures into pieces. As the Bibliotheque Mazarine is engulfed in flames, the pair escape back to the TARDIS. Those charts reveal that in 2 days' time there will be a solar eclipse, plunging everything into shadow. We then cut to the Palace of Versailles, where King Louis XIV is busy playing outdoor chess. Bursting in, the Doctor and Julie try to warn them that Richelieu is an agent of a foreign power, and plans to seize control of France. The imminent celebration of the Sun King needs to be cancelled. Suddenly, the King's eyes start to bleed blackness, and a portal opens behind him, containing Verloc, Richelieu, and a horde of tentacled, bug-eyed monsters. The darkness has anticipated everything. So an action-packed and revelatory issue then, with a cliffhanger that would have been difficult to predict. Time's seriously out of joint, and although I assume there's going to be some kind of reset in the final part, I hope it's not at the expense of the storyline. We had quite enough of that with Supremacy of the Cybermen. I have to say I really enjoyed how the story flowed from scene to scene and the way the flashback was integrated. Robbie Morrison's written enough comics by now to know how to pace these things properly. Good Doctor Who always takes real history and tweaks it slightly, and this is no exception. There really was a cabinet noir where the letters of suspected people were opened by officials before being sent on to their final destinations. Although it was not until Louis XIV's successor that a separate office was created. Even Napoleon used it on occasion. For once, there was actually a decent use of the screwdriver as a sonic device. Far better to have it as an amplifier of sound rather than a magic wand that can do almost anything the user can imagine. I also like the growing interplay between the Doctor and Julie d'Aubigny. He likes her far more than he lets on. If I have one small niggle with this issue, it's that it was a shame the gargoyles turned out to be robots. It'd have been more in keeping with the Cthulhu monsters from another dimension feel if they'd been shape changers, for example. Art and colour-wise, it's more of the quality we've come to expect from Mariano and his team. I particularly like the black squiggles around the panel borders of the flashback to signify the presence of the darkness and how its influence grew. The one odd illustration was a full page near the end as the Doctor and Julie race for the TARDIS through the burning library. The drawings are fine. It's the colours which seem totally different from the rest of the book. Normally there's this soft, almost translucent quality, but for this page the brightness seems to have been turned right up. I'm not sure if it's a printing error or the result of tight deadlines, but it does look somewhat out of place. All in all then, everything's set for an exciting conclusion in Part 3, which I'll take a look at in just a moment. But now, it's time for Torchwood. Last year, the good folk at BBC Audio released a whole plethora of new audio material. There are also compilations of previously published stuff under the Tales banner. Alongside box sets for the 10th and 11th Doctors, we also have Torchwood Tales, a collection of all the audio-exclusive dramas that came out between 2008 and 2012, before Big Finish got the licence. It's 10 separate stories across multiple CDs, over 18 hours of adventures featuring the vocal talents of the stars of the BBC television series. I was lucky enough to get a review copy of this box set as an early Christmas present from BBC Audio. And over the next few months I'm going to listen to all of the CDs and give you my thoughts on how they turn out. Although I'm familiar with and enjoyed many of the Doctor Who audio news stories from Big Finish and others, I've not heard any Torchwood ones before, so this will be an interesting new experience. I'll be honest, I watched the first series of Torchwood on television out of a sense of loyalty to the parent show, and because I originally enjoyed the character of Captain Jack Harkness. However, after the initial excitement of having a brand new spin-off of Doctor Who wore off, like many people, I struggled with the immensely smug and unlikable characters, the at times appalling dialogue, the incompetent acting, the misjudged plot. I could go on. Oh, and there were brighter points amongst the mediocre schlock of those first 12 episodes. Countryside was disturbingly nasty, and Random Shoes was gentle and heartfelt. But beware, Mr. Chibnall, no matter how good you turn out to be as a showrunner on Doctor Who, fandom will never forgive you for Cyberwoman. Of course, Torchwood did pick up slightly with Season 2, and then amazingly turned into must-see TV for Children of Earth, before taking the quickest nosedives in history with the live-along and frankly dull Miracle Day. So I'll be honest, it was with some trepidation that I cracked open the case of Torchwood Tales and took out the first CD. Were these stories going to be Season 1 bad, or Season 3 brilliant? Let's find out. The first adventure out of the box is Hidden, written by Stephen Saville and read by Naoko Mori, who played Toshiko Sato. I've only come across Saville's name before in connection with a couple of novels about the 2000 AD character Slain. But looking at his bio, he's written quite a lot, including books in the Warhammer universe and various TV tie-in stories. The first thing to say that this is not an audio play, it's an audio novel, a reading of a short story, complete with chapter breaks. After listening to so many Big Finish full-cast dramas, it took a bit of adjustment, as I don't really listen to audio versions of books, preferring the personal experience of hearing and imagining the characters in my own mind. Still, being that I'm always open to something new. Anyway, what's the plot? Well, the apparent murder of a mysterious scientist and philanthropist leads to Captain Jack Harkless being arrested and facing a plethora of different questions. The rest of the team are on their own trying to work out where he is and why a number of other seemingly unconnected people are also being killed. Plus, how does this all tie into a fertility clinic, a 17th century alchemist looking for the secret of eternal life, and a temple-like secret society trying to silence anyone who gets in their way? If at this point you're thinking, that sounds more Da Vinci Code than Torchwood, you'd be right. And much like Dan Brown's novels, this story features small bursts of action interspersed by huge amounts of leaden historical exposition. The only real highlights, and I use that term loosely, are a car chase sequence in which Yanto drives like a maniac and gets himself seriously injured, and a tense scene at the clinic as Gwen and Owen trying to avoid a couple of gun-wielding assassins. Captain Jack's absent for most of the action, as we cut back and forth to him in the police interrogation room and he makes a few quips before vanishing off stage again. The rest of the time it's business as usual with the rest of the Season 1 team, with Owen being particularly unpleasant as usual. Yanto's the one that probably comes off best out of this. The problem is it's all so flat. It meanders along, never really rising above mediocre. The team runs around a bit, looks into a few things, the details of which I can't even really remember, and then it just all gets muddled and fizzles out at the end. Had I dozed off? I found myself skipping back a couple of tracks just in case I'd missed an important climactic revelation. Nope, that's all there is. It's not even a real central villain, or I didn't notice one. The Secret Society guys are little more than hired thugs. Even Dan Brown has a few interesting characters. It's not helped by an equally pedestrian reading from Naoko Mori. She does her best with a dodgy American accent for Jack and tries gamely to inject some modicum of excitement into the few action sequences, but generally she sounds about as excited with the story as if she's reading a dictionary. I'm not surprised really when it's all either historically dry or modern day dull. Not a great start then. But hope prevails, so let's do another one. Next up is Everyone Says Hello by Dan Abnett and read by Bern Gorman. Abnett I'm very familiar with from his vast body of work for 2000 AD, where he created Sinister Dexter, from DC where he did an excellent run on the Legion of Superheroes with co-writer Andy Lanning, and for Marvel where the pair revitalised the cosmic side of that universe in a way that I don't think has been equalled since. He's also a prolific novelist, particularly in the Warhammer 40,000 sandbox, and I'm not a real lover of those books, but I have read a few. And I do have to say that Necropolis, in his Gaunt's Ghost series, is one of the most intense and enjoyable future war novels I've ever read. The title of the story gives you the core idea. One morning, random people just start saying, hello, to complete strangers, including Owen Harper, and revealing lots of personal details about their lives, likes, dislikes, secrets, you get the idea. At the same time, the team in the Torchwood Hub detect a powerful psychokinetic energy field that came through the Cardiff Rift. As more and more people just stand around saying, hello, and divulging their darkest secrets, normal life grinds to a halt. Fires break out, cars crash. Those few that are unaffected by the phenomenon start to get attacked by the rest, who became known as greeters, and the city descends into mayhem. Inside a garage on a disused lot, a strange light is pulsing and summoning some of the greeters into its presence. They are to be heralds, who will act as knowledge conduits between the light and mankind. But first, Torchwood must be disposed of. There's more to all of this, of course, but I don't want to reveal too much, otherwise it will spoil the enjoyment of the story. So what did I think? Well, I was right to trust Mr. Abnett. This is more like it. Dan knows how to write interesting characters, and much of the early running time is devoted to lots of little scenes with supposedly insignificant people. Little vignettes or slices of life that paint a lovely detailed portrait of the person that's either affected by or confronted with this strange situation. As these scenes progress, we start to meet a few of the major supporting characters, or come back to early ones that start to take on more significance. Take ex-convict Vic Royce, for example. You start off thinking that he's just a random taxi driver that's exposed to one of the greeters, but then things take a left turn and he becomes very important to the plot. The Torchwood main cast came off really well as well under Dabnitt's pen. Well, apart from Tosh, but then she's so bland I don't think even Alan Moore could turn into something interesting. Jack gets a lot more airtime in this one, and we get inside his head a little too. As things progress, Jack's really at risk of being subsumed into the ranks of the greeters. And there's a definite zombie movie feel to things as the supposedly pleasant people turn nasty and start hounding our heroes with crude weapons. Never has such a simple single word sounded so frightening. A big part of the success of this audio is the reading from Byrne Gorman. Now, I'm not one of his biggest fans, but with this he reveals that his portrayal of Owen Harper was probably hampered by poor choices by RTD and Chibnall when they created his character. Gorman really gets stuck into the story, adding dynamism and variety to all the various roles. His Welsh accents are excellent, and it must be very difficult to come up with 100 different ways to say hello, but he manages it, and sounds like he's really enjoying telling the story. Some might think that the ending comes a bit quick, but I don't think it's out of step with the rest of the adventure. This is less about Torchwood and more about the little people that get caught up in the wake of big alien events, and I really like that focus. I thoroughly enjoyed the two CDs, and I'll make an effort to seek out other Torchwood stories by Dan Abnett, and hope they're as good as this one. Right, just time to go back to our Doctor Who comic story in progress. Before the break, we found out that King Louis XIV is enthralled with the other dimensional menace known as the Darkness. Hopefully nothing to do with that awful rock band from Suffolk. Let's see how the Doctor gets out of this one. One point of note, our colourist has changed for this issue to Hernan Cabrera. Is he Carlos's evil twin brother from an alternate dimension? Who knows? So, the Doctor taunts Richelieu that all this darkness and horror stuff doesn't frighten a Time Lord. But he just gloats about how the dark matter creatures have seen our light-infused universe and decided that we don't deserve it. When the real Cardinal meddled with forces he didn't understand, he created a bridge that let them in. And now as the total eclipse of the sun begins, they will eradicate all life. Seized by the black tendrils, the Doctor is thankfully saved by the blade of a certain swordsman, and he returns the favour with a repeat of the sonic amplifier trick, which disorientates the possessed humans and enabling he and Julie to escape into the gardens of Versailles. Ducking musket shots, they dash into the King's maze where the TARDIS is hidden. But unfortunately they become separated and Julie is confronted by a cackling Captain Verloc, wisps of pitch black coiling from every orifice, and the Doctor has vanished. Sometime later in the Bastille prison in Paris, we find Julie locked in a cell awaiting the call to be executed. The celebration of the Sun King is in full swing and everybody is too busy having fun to pay attention to the actual orb in the sky. Led to the chopping block, Julie prepares to meet her fate, only to notice that the executioner is really the Doctor in disguise, and he cuts her chains just as the moon starts to cover the sun, and Cardinal Richelieu appears wielding arcane energies like something out of a Doctor Strange comic. Our favourite Time Lord has a few tricks of his own up his sleeve, and he hands Julie an energy saw left on the TARDIS by a swashbuckling captain I once knew. I wonder who that could be. As the total eclipse reaches zenith, hideous Lovecraftian creatures erupt amongst the revelling crowds and begin to consume them. Racing inside Notre Dame Cathedral, the Doctor confronts his enemies in front of a swirling eddy, but the coils of dark matter knock the sonic screwdriver out of his grasp. Throwing her energy sword, Julie gives the Doctor just one chance to get it back before she herself is captured by the darkness. It turns out the Doctor's been busy during her incarceration. The press of her control sets the TARDIS off through space, and it creates a vortex allowing the filtered light of the Sabahagan quasar, the brightest star in the universe, to shine down on Earth, countering the effects of the eclipse and dispelling the dark shadows. Unable to resist the power of the light, the darkness creatures dissolve. Verloc disintegrates, and Cardinal Richelieu finds that time has last caught up with him, and he ages to death in an instant. Thankfully, Julie and King Louis XIV were not transformed by the darkness, only controlled, so they return to normal. It's over. Julie decides that she'll allow the Doctor to take her on a trip in the TARDIS, with him operating as her butler. But he's really not sure. There's only one way to decide this. Sword fight! So in the end, to my surprise, time wasn't reversed. At least not in this story. Richelieu did live an extra 50 years and basically rule Paris. I guess the web of time has a way of absorbing these kind of minor anomalies and reasserting the proper flow of events afterwards. As for the Doctor's solution to the problem of the dark matter invasion, it might seem at first to be something he's pulled out of a hat. But don't forget he's a time traveller. It could have taken days or even weeks for him to figure out what to do, and then a quick hop back in the TARDIS brings him back just in time to replace the Axeman and save everyone. That's my theory anyway. Criticisms? Well, there's a little disappointing to say the same sonic screwdriver emplaning singing voice trick used twice in two consecutive issues. Although the scene where the Doctor and Julie are escaping Versailles and end up looking for the TARDIS at the maze also seems a little odd. The Doctor appears to have forgotten where he parked the old girl only a few minutes ago. Lastly, apart from allowing the Doctor to conduct a last-minute rescue to further the plot, I'm not quite sure why Verloc put Julie in the Bastille instead of immediately having her absorbed by the darkness. I really do like Julie d'Aubigny as a companion. She's kind of a 17th century Leela crossed with Donal Noble. Violent and feisty, but with less Jane of Thorns and more boozing. And a refreshing change from the simpering female companions that just think the Doctor's wonderful. I hope she sticks around. The artwork for this final part is still generally excellent. Mariano's black tendrils wind across many pages, neatly illustrating the creeping evil of the darkness. And he definitely draws nasty-looking monsters from before the dawn of time. There are a few facial expressions that are a little off, but I'm nitpicking. It's the changing colourist to Mirror Universe Cabrera where there's a noticeable difference. Maybe it's the same person and they've just changed their style or their software. But I just don't like the overall effect as much as previous issues by this team. It just seems less three-dimensional somehow. But these are all small points, though, in what's been a hugely enjoyable three-issue romp. It's probably one of the best overall stories in this U2 run. Okay, that's been far too much for me for one session. Time to go. I'll leave you with a quote from the late, great John Hurt, who once said about his lack of belief in an afterlife. I just hope I have the courage to say, vroom, here we go. Let's become different molecules. More next time. Bye.
So there you go. Thank you, Kevin. Thank you, Lex. Speaking of Lex, she's already submitted her next piece for the TARDIS Library, so look out for another episode of this show before the end of the month. I know February is a short month, but I'm sure we'll be doing another TARDIS Library before the end of it. That's very exciting. What did you think of the reviews? Are you reading any of these comics? Are you listening to any of these audios? Are there things you'd like to hear us do on the TARDIS Library? Would you like to submit something to the TARDIS Library? There's a question for you. You can always write to us at hello@thedwshow.net and let us know. And until next time, happy times and places.